Inner Space shrinks down Dennis Quaid and injects his tiny ship into the body of Martin Shore. Yeah, seriously, that is the premise. Coming from director Joe Dante, though, I'm pretty confident that we're all going to have a super fun time. Welcome, everyone, to the Atomic Cinema Experiment. I am Peter, and joining me, as always, is David.
I come in peace.
What's that voice? Who's speaking to me?
It's me, not Martin Short.
Martin Tall. Okay, good. Welcome, everyone. It's a science fiction movie podcast, and today's episode was a vote winner. We're doing 80s votes over at Patreon every month right now. And this winner is for basically a category that was like different ship types. So there was a spaceship movie, there was like a submarine movie, and this is the movie that won, which is a ship that goes inside someone's body. Someone shrinks down and goes inside. I guess you could compare it to what was that movie called? Fantastic Voyage from the 60s, yes. Which is a kind of a broadly similar idea. But this is directed by Joe Dante, and we're going to talk about this. We'll start spoiler-free, of course, as we always do. It's from 1987, and I'll just say before we get into it, if you're enjoying the show, do hit the like button. It helps us out a bunch if you're watching on YouTube, to hit the button. And, of course, you can get bonus shows from me and David that we do monthly over at patreon.com/mailfuzzTV. I'll tell you more about them at the end of the show. But let's get into Inner Space. I'm curious, David, had you seen Inner Space before?
No, I had not seen Inner Space. And honestly, I thought going into it, like I had a pretty good grasp as to what the movie was going to be. Mm-hmm. But then I realized, I think I was thinking of Fantastic Voyage.
Yeah.
So when this one started up and it had a very different tone from what I was expecting, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm into it. I want to see how this is turning out now.
Yeah, I'd seen this once before. This was actually... I'm a big fan of Joe Dante. I kind of grew up watching Explorers a lot as a kid. As like, I watched that kind of side-by-side with the Goonies growing up. And, later in life, I kind of discovered other things that he'd done, like Small Soldiers, Matinee, you know, stuff like that. But I love his filmography. I think he's very good at doing kind of fun movies. Like, he's very good at sort of balancing this thing where you take a sort of high concept kind of thing. Like, you know, he did Gremlins, and then he did Gremlins 2, which is just a piss take of doing sequels.
Yeah.
This is one of his films that I hadn't seen until much, much later. I was already, like, at least way into my 20s before I saw this one. And was excited about it. It's got some of the hallmarks that he has. Dick Miller pops up for a cameo because he's in every Joe Dante movie. That's one of his staples, is he always gets at least a cameo. But yeah, it's a fun concept. It's this simple idea of someone shrinking down a ship, just one person who ends up inside another person and can communicate with the person they're inside of. So you've got this, not quite puppeteering because they're not in control of the person, but you kind of literally have someone be this inner voice. So you have this confident guy, overconfident actually, whose arc obviously has to be that he needs to grow up a little bit and sort of be less of a douche. And then you've got the character that he goes inside, who is this hypochondriac, nervous guy who could do with more confidence, who could do with a lesson in being a bit more brave and a bit more, out there. So it's a perfect kind of match as far as your character arcs are supposed to go. And it's a fun idea. It's filled with cast that we'll talk about in a minute, but I had a lot of fun when I first watched this. I had fun watching it again now. It definitely takes some big swings as far as like I'm not saying it's grounded science by any means, but it sets up rules early on and it kind of follows them. But it also introduces some other wilder things later on that feel like, oh, I guess they can just do this now. But I think because Joe Dante movies are always more interested in, okay, what can we do with the fun concept and how can we have fun with the characters in that fun concept? It always feels like it's being used smartly, even if you're like, well, they've not really justified why this thing works this way. But it's okay because what they're doing with it is too much fun to really complain about. So,
yeah, I really appreciate in this movie of, like you said, there's a lot of big swings. There's a lot of times where if you really paused and you thought about, does that make any sense at all with what we've like been established here? 50-50. You're going to hit or miss on that one. But all of it is always in service of telling a better story. It's always there of, we are forwarding the plot in a interesting new direction because we're introducing this new curveball that is genuinely usually a interesting idea, at least as far as this movie goes. I'm not nearly as experienced on Joe Dante as you are, but this one seems to work out.
For sure. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just ask the question. What did you think of Innerspace?
So when I thought it was just Fantastic Voyage, I was kind of expecting it to be pretty much like every other time I've seen the sort of like miniaturized story, whether it be on like sitcoms or animation or whatever like that, which is essentially they go around in the little ship and they just start like poking at stuff. And then it does stuff to the guy outside, but he's never really aware as to what's going on. And obviously, that's not the way this movie went. Early on, he's aware of the guy inside of him, and they form a little compadre there. I think what gets me the most is the comedy of it, because it basically is a comedy. Yes, there's some like action adventure in there, obviously sci-fi elements, but it's just funny the whole way through. And I think that was the most surprising part for me. I should have realized once Martin Short's name was on it that it was going to be a comedy, but I didn't see that until I started up the movie. So, yeah, overall, I enjoyed it. I think it was great casting. I think that Dennis Quaid does a great job of that just over-the-top, like, confidence character. And then Martin Short, I'm very happy they picked him rather than just, I don't know. There's certain roles that are perfect for the more slapstick rather than just the generally funny actors, like comedians. Mm. And I think Martin Short was absolutely cast perfect for this role. So, yeah, I enjoyed it overall.
Martin Short's one of those weird actors to me who I somehow like know who he is. Mm-hmm. But other than this movie, I don't feel like I've seen him in that much, even though he's clearly a name that people talk about and he's in a lot of things. I just feel like I don't see a lot of it, but here he is.
I mean, you watched Santa Claus 3.
Of course, yes. Speaking of connections, this is a wild one, which I only caught when I looked at the actor in IMDb. So one of the characters in this, the villains have this henchman who has a robotic hand. More on him later when we get into spoilers. But that actor was in The Road Warrior. And notably, in that review when we talked about The Road Warrior, Mad Max 2, I said how I barely recognized him from Commando because he looks so different. He then looks very different again in this movie, because in this movie, he's always wearing sunglasses, he's clean shaven, he's got like, you know, kind of, he's not long hair, it's still short hair, but it's not like shaven down like military style, it's more just kind of normal, I guess. In Commando, he's got a Freddie Mercury mustache and the hair's trimmed down shorter and he's always wearing kind of like this vest kind of thing. And then in Mad Max 2, he's wearing like a mohawk and he's got like, you know, silly Raider gear on.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him at all.
He's so different. I sort of like smiled when I saw the name Vernon Wells and went, oh shit, this guy is a chameleon. He just keeps changing how he looks.
Yeah.
So,
Me.
It was fun to see him there. But this is actually a pretty stacked cast. You got Dennis Quaid as Pendleton, who is the pilot of the ship who ends up inside Martin Short.
Yep.
Martin Short plays Jack Potter. We'll probably just call him Jack, I guess, going forward.
And by the way, Dennis Quaid's first name is Tuck as well, in case we say that.
Oh, sure, yeah. I don't think ever was, just because I've never heard the name Tuck before. I've never heard someone called Tuck.
Never heard Tuck?
No, that's very American.
I mean, it's not common, but it's not like an unheard of name. It's Tuck. Mostly in TV stuff. Tuck Everlasting is the only thing that pops in my head, which is some chick flick from like the early 2000s.
And there we go. Meg Ryan is the love interest character. Now, what's funny is, and I happened to look up Meg Ryan as I was watching this, just because I was like, you know, I was thinking, man, she was like a big thing in the late 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And I'm like, she just kind of disappeared after that. And I was just looking to see if she was in stuff. And she was. She's in like a lot of stuff I've not seen in like TV shows and stuff. But I didn't know until I looked her up. I noticed it said Child Jack Quaid. And I went, wait a minute. And I was like, wait, her and Dennis Quaid actually got married. not too long after this movie. Well, a few years after this movie. But this may have been where they met. I don't know.
I saw a trivia bit. This is where they met. They dated for a while, got married, and then divorced because Meg Ryan had an affair. So
I didn't know that, but that was like in 2001. Yep. Just because I only know that because I happen to be looking at this specifically in the middle of the movie. But I did not know this was Jack Quaid's mom. That was a reveal to me when I was watching this movie.
Listen, nepotism is alive and well, no matter how talented the actor is.
But here's the thing though, right? He's got Dennis Quaid as a father, Meg Ryan as a mother.
Yeah.
What do you think visiting Uncle Randy?
I'd imagine it's literally just the character from Independence Day. Like, that's all it is.
I was thinking Christmas Vacation, but okay.
That works too, yeah.
I was like, he's just got a trailer somewhere and he's got all these weird hygiene problems and...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same with the Howards. Like, I imagine Bryce Dallas Howard going to Uncle Clint's for Christmas and just like how weird that was. But all right, you know.
I mean, I can't imagine any celebrity family getting together. You know, it's one of those things where like you exist in your own world separate of this. And until I see you starring in something together, you don't exist together.
Damn. Okay. We also have one of the villain characters, sort of the money man behind the villains, is played by Kevin McCarthy, who most famously, I'd probably say, is the main character from the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers from the 50s. So that's a fun callback to that. Plus other roles we have here, Robert Picardo, who most people know from Star Trek Voyager. He plays the cowboy, more on him later. And then some minor roles. We got Wendy Schall in there, who I only really know because she's in a couple of Joe Dante movies. She's in The Burbs, which is another great movie, by the way. I love The Burbs. But she was in Small Soldiers as well, and I'm sure she's popped up in other things, but that's mainly where I know her from. So, yeah, a lot of faces. There's a lot of faces in here. You know, I mentioned the Dick Miller cameo. He pops up as a cab driver early on, but...
Yeah, I would say this movie has a big cast in terms of, like, total number of characters with speaking lines and like engagement into the plot, but most all of them are just kind of tangential. Like they show up for one, two scenes tops, and then they just disappear. The main focuses really are trio and then like two of the villains at any given time.
I should probably just throw in here, I didn't know the actress, which is what I didn't mention earlier, but Fiona Lewis plays another villain, like the lady scientist who works for the bad guy.
Yes.
She's like the other prominent character that should be mentioned just for, you know, the plot, which... It's funny, like, her character is very horny, and it stuck out to me watching it because I feel like it's just a little bit more risque than I'm used to in a Joe Dante movie. Maybe I'm misremembering something, but there's a scene that they don't show it too explicitly, but it's very implied, and we'll get to the context later in spoilers, but it's very implied there's a vibrator in a scene, and they just kind of, like, they almost just sort of, like, whoosh it past the camera as quickly as possible just to get that PG-13 rating or whatever they were getting at the time. But I was like, damn, that was actually a little bit, you know, sexy for a Joe Dante movie.
You say it's implied, and I guess by like the definition of implied, you're right, but it is right up, it's like just skirting the edge of like, it can't be anything else. Like it has to be a vibrator.
It's as close as possible without outright confirming it.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is, but it's very clear. But that stuck out to me for that reason. So, it's got fun effects. I think this is something to talk about as well. Is that all of the stuff with the ship going through the body is you know, it's all practical effects where they've got a model and they've got these big like particles. You know, they're probably big styrofoam things painted or whatever going through liquid or whatnot, but it's meant to look like blood cells or look like something else, you know?
Yeah, apparently, I mean, all of the effects were done by ILM, which obviously they were doing great stuff around this time in terms of practical effects. Apparently, all of the blood cells were made of jello.
Like
it was given that specific look to it, which, again, that just comes down to the practicality of it. It really fits in well, unlike some movies that we've done where it's like, that boulder is very clearly just styrofoam.
Yes. Specifically, you're making me think of Avalanche that we did over in Collector's Cut with that comment. But the effects are really cool, and I think there's a sense of wonderment to it. It's actually produced by Spielberg, and it doesn't feel exactly like a Spielberg movie, But it definitely, you can feel it a little bit. I always kind of think of Joe Dante as being kind of like the cheeky sibling to Spielberg, because his movies don't have the same kind of mass market appeal, but it's like he's doing the little kind of cheekier adjacent Spielberg-esque movies, and that's what this movie feels like to me, particularly early on when Dennis Quaid's like getting ready to go into the ship and like this inspirational music's playing. But there's kind of like just a little bit of an attitude that you wouldn't get in a Spielberg movie to go along with it. And yeah, you know, it's a very particular vibe that I feel Dante tends to hit quite well.
It feels like Spielberg is the Saturday morning cartoon, whereas this is more of the like MTV style. It's just a little bit of extra grunge to it, but obviously still meant for a younger audience.
Yeah. And I think a lot of Dante's films, outside of maybe Piranha, which he did before he started, and The Howling, which he did before all the other things, and those are by far my least favorite of his stuff, because once he gets into his 80s era, where he's doing Gremlins, into The Burbs, into this, into whatever, and that's not the order he did them in, but like once he gets into what I think of Joe Dante movies, like I feel like he doesn't really miss all that much. There's a... There tends to be a sense, like I say, of like taking the subject or the concept serious enough, but never taking it ultra serious to the point where it's not working. Like, I think with a concept of this, where someone goes inside a human body and they're communicating with the person, you can do a lot of fun narrative things with that. You can do a lot of character building with that, because you've literally got the helping voice inside your head. But at the same time, like to take it with the right attitude, you can't be taking it ultra seriously, because then you start questioning the science behind it. You know, you have to have this nice balance in the middle where you're taking it serious enough to make good narrative points and actually doing something with the characters, but you're not taking it so seriously that you're actually kind of, you know, like I said, there's a bad guy in this with a robot hand. Okay, there's these wild elements. There's a character called the Cowboy who is nothing but a joke in terms of like the point of him.
Like, I think the best way to say it, even in Joe Dante's filmography, is don't think about the rules of the Gremlins too deeply, because then you'll come into the line of, like, what counts as after midnight? Like, is it by the clock? Is it by where the sun is? When am I allowed to start again?
To be fair, he pokes fun at that in the second one, where someone starts questioning, what if they fly over a time zone? Like, what happens then?
Exactly.
But the important thing is, though, is that even in Gremlins, the rules still make sense, though, in the context of the movie, because you understand the consequences of any of those rules being broken. Yes, if you stop and think about, okay, but what about all these other factors that could affect them? But in the context of the movie to tell its story, them getting wet does this thing, and we understand what that leads to. Them eating after midnight does this thing, we understand what it leads to, so on and so on.
In terms of this movie, there's not as many like rules per se, but it's just kind of the shrinking process works in a very specific way. And then they just keep on doing twists on that. They keep saying like, okay, well, in order to get big again, you have to do this. You can also not shrink all the way down to microscopic size. There's like a range in between. And they keep on just playing with that and throwing out those sort of new ideas.
Yeah, and they shake things up about how Pendleton can affect Jack by doing something on the inside, but then also how Jack can affect Pendleton by getting nervous, so his heart rate goes up, for example, just as a quick idea. But like, there's a lot of things like that where how they affect each other in different ways, and that stuff's really good. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so no, all really good. It's a very sort of traditional 80s movie score. There's a bit of hijinks in there. There's a lot of like sort of wonderment and heartfelt kind of moments in the score. Yeah, I think it really feels like one of those movies that I should have seen as a kid, and I would have probably loved it as a kid, but I just happened not to. So it was when I finally got to see it when I was like 27 or whatever age I was when I finally saw it, it was like, oh, this is cool to see this because I appreciate this, and it's harkening back. It's like I'm feeling nostalgia for it, even though I never saw it as a kid. It's still fitting, and it feels so much of that time that it works that way.
It's one of those things where when you're a kid, there's certain movies that can introduce like a lifelong love of something, or at least very much filling your childhood. Like kids who grew up with Jurassic Park are, you know, they were dinosaur kids. They were like, oh, look at all the different types of dinosaurs I've memorized and stuff like that. And you got that sort of stuff for space. You got that sort of stuff for like fish and stuff like that. There's always a movie that introduces that. I don't feel like this movie would quite be like an introduction of, oh, I'm really interested in like human biology or anything like that,
because
it doesn't really focus that much on it. But I do think kids would get enjoyment out of this just in how quirky and fun it's being. It's just a fun time overall.
Yeah. So, it's a very entertaining movie, and I think we can probably get into spoilers unless there's something else you'd like to bring up.
The only thing I'd like to say is that every week on this show, I go back and I watch a movie that you and Tara did before, and I will continue that on this episode. So that'll be at the end of it.
Yeah, one week I'll remember to actually say that in the intro, and I always forget.
That's fine. It gives me something to say here.
So yeah, spoilers for Innerspace. You have been warned. We're going to go through the movie and talk about the ups and downs. The introduction to the movie is very much the backstory of Pendleton, who is a bit of a screw-up. He's supposed to be, you know, a test pilot. He's supposed to be successful, but instead he's at this banquet celebrating all these other test pilots, and he is getting blame drunk and making a fool of himself. And that's how we kick the movie off. And everyone's embarrassed by him. He's kind of thrown away his career, however which way. And we're introduced to him and also Meg Ryan's character, Lydia, who is tasked with taking him home because they're already in kind of a relationship by this point. Yeah.
It seems like they've been in like a long-term on and off sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she's like, this is just him. He gets drunk constantly, but you can tell that it's bothering her throughout.
Yeah, she takes him home and he turns on their song, and that gets her to, you know, it fades to black as if, okay, that wooed her, it worked. They had a night together. Mm-hmm. But she clearly regrets it in the morning, and we get this whole funny scene where she's, you know, she comes out to the cab and Dick Miller's, and she's complaining to Dick Miller because, I told you not to beep the horn. I told the people on the phone not to beep the horn. And then Dennis Quaid runs out in his towel and tries to stop her from going. The end of the scene is particularly funny because he gets his towel caught in the cab door, and she drives off down the San Francisco hill, and he's standing there butt-ass naked, yelling at Lydia kind of thing.
You know, it was actually, like, I assume that he has some sort of, like, modesty bikini somehow, like, that's only in the front. But that was not a soundstage. That was definitely a San Francisco hill.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
all I
outdoors.
Could think is, like, oh, these Quaids just causing trouble.
It's funny, actually, because in The Boys, there was an extended couple of scenes in season 3, because Huey was, he was teleporting, and every time he would do it, he would teleport without his clothes. So there was a lot of naked Jack Quaid on The Boys.
Learning from his father.
Yeah. A couple of things to point out is that he's clearly already taken the assignment of this gig that we jumped to in 2 months, because he's already got references to it at his place, because there's all these like bunny-related things, and it's because the experiment that he's supposed to do is that he's going to go in the ship, shrink down, and the test is going to be to put them into a bunny, which makes sense because bunnies are often, you know, the phrase test bunny is literally a thing. So
I have never heard that being a thing, but all right.
Really?
Nah.
Yeah, you test on rabbits. That's the thing.
There's the laboratory mice.
You have lab rats. Mice.
Yeah, lab rats, but test bunnies, I don't feel like I've heard that.
People test on bunnies. That's the thing.
Oh, yeah. No, they definitely do. I've just never heard it talked about. Nobody wants to say, like, look at this adorable little animal we're injecting stuff into.
We're injecting the animal with Dennis Quaid.
Ah, yes. The standard tests.
But I mean, it sets up that this relationship is doomed. She runs away from him. But it's all very entertaining. Like, them bickering at each other in front of Dick Miller. And Dick Miller interjecting a little bit where he's like, oh, yeah, nice clean break. This is what's good. And then they say something to sort of tell him to shut up. And he's like, oh, so it's like a one-night thing. And then they get really mad and tell him to shut up. And I enjoyed the interjections there.
You telling me that Dick Miller is a recurring makes that role make so much more sense. Because it seemed oddly strange that he was talking so much to them.
it's not that intrusive, but I think it's like, if you're a long-time Joe Dante fan, you get to enjoy the Dick Miller cameo.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's more than a cameo. He's got a bigger character in some of the movies, like in Gremlins, but...
Well, I would hope so.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think right away you get that the chemistry between the actors and how they're bouncing off of each other is going to be a big part of the movie. And that is going to be a big part of the movie. Like, that's the fun of this year. So we jump ahead 2 months. And there's a guy who we saw at the, what's his name here? Blanchard, Pete Blanchard, who was at the airspace thing before at the start of the movie. He's actually been taken by a scientist to be shown this experiment that's going to have Dennis Quaid in it doing the piloting. And we get some build up to this. We see all this kind of play out.
I do think that this scene, I don't want to say it's weird because it works for whatever it is it's trying to do. It's just establishing that he's coming in essentially as like funding or like connections to possibly like military or whatever. He's providing something to this experiment if it works. But the purpose of the scene is to basically say, here's who Dennis Quaid's character is now, 2 months later, and like historically who he was as well. And they keep saying how he's like, you know, he rejects authority. He makes up his own rules. He does whatever. But everything he's saying, I don't feel like that's the character we end up seeing at all. Like, he goes by the book. He does everything that he's supposed to do during the thing. So I don't know why we took this time to say that he's a rebel without a cause here.
Yeah, I think this character, it's debatable how much you need of him early on here. I think the important thing about this character, though, is that later on, his attitude towards Quaid's character is going to motivate some decisions for about how Quaid and Martin Short tackle the next part of the movie, and that's why he's important. I think the bigger thing here is the build-up to the experiment, and Dennis Quaid does come out as if he's a rock star in front of all the scientists. He kisses one of the scientists on the mouth. He's like high-fiving the others. Like, he treats this like he's having a fun day. You know,
I mean, to be fair, everything I know about test pilots, which isn't much, but the one thing I know is how absolutely like cocky and over the top they are about their own selves. So that fits with what I have a general idea for.
He's up his own ass, which is ironic because in a few minutes time, he's going to be up someone else's ass.
Speaking of which, do we want to talk about the doctor scene with Jack Putter?
Yeah, that's interspersed here in that we get an introduction to Short's character. To establish he's a hypochondriac, that he's scared of everything. He's at the doctor's. The doctor at one point in this scene points out that, you know, he's not mad that he's a hypochondriac because his repeated visits is the cornerstone of his entire medical practice. So he's very enthusiastic about it. But, you know, Martin Short's kicking the trays over. He's getting nervous.
Yeah, we immediately get into the slapstick routine where he's just throwing himself around the room, basically.
Yeah, he talks about this nightmare he's having of the cash, because he's actually, I don't think you get in this scene necessarily that he actually has this job. I just thought it was a dream until we actually see that the job later. But he's working at the cash register at Safeway, and the items are ringing up incorrectly, and they're like, it ends up being like $100,000 for like a, you know, this bag of groceries, and he gets scared of the woman who's got big mean red hair. I think he puts it as.
Yeah,
and you know, he wakes up, she pulls out this gun, and he wakes up before he's shot, which is normal for dreams. You tend to wake up before you die in dreams. That tends to be a thing.
But he was just like, this thing was not just an anxiety dream to him. This was a full like nightmare. He was like, I was going to die, and this is just one of many nightmares I have because I am so incapable of dealing with the world.
The important part of the scene, though, is that this motivates the doctor to tell him that he should go on a break, he should relax, maybe have a vacation, which is why Potter's going to be at the mall at the travel agency in a little bit. So that's setting up some important stuff there. So, it's a very economical scene, right? Because it sets up who the character is, his personality type, and it motivates, from a logic reason, why he's at the location that he's going to be at that's important in a few minutes' time. So, you know, very, very economical. I think, you know, the movie's 2 hours long, but I don't think the pacing ever felt poor to me.
No, it made sense, everything that they did. I would say that there are some sequences which, while they are fun, are definitely just diversions. Definitely just, like, trying to take a little detour off to the side before we get back in. But because I had fun with everything, it wasn't ever a part where I'm sitting there going, okay, let's get back to things now.
I mean, I think it's as long as it could be. Like, I think if it went any longer than 2 hours, it would be, you know, barking up the pacing police, if you will. So
you get the theater chains just being like, we can't fit in as many shows, guys. You only can go 2 hours.
Yeah, but now every theater's got at least like 12 screens, so no one cares anymore.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So basically, the big turning point here at the start of the movie is that there's industrial espionage. Competing places want this tech. They want this shrinking tech. So just as the experiment's happening and they shrink down Dennis Quaid and they put him into a syringe with liquid, the idea being that they can inject him then into the rabbit, this is just when the villains show up to fix the phone lines, which I've never seen like 8 people show up to fix one phone line, but...
It's a big building. There's a lot of phones. My favorite part is that the guy says, we're here to fix the phones, and then the security guard goes and picks up a phone to call back and be like, do you know anything about fixing the phones? No? All right, never mind.
I mean, to be fair, to play devil's advocate, this is clearly a building with multiple phone lines, and not to mention the fact that this particular phone line he's using is an internal phone line, so that might not relate to...
I'm sure it's fine. I just found it funny.
Yes. It may have even been an intentional little gag, knowing the sense of humor that Dante and co have. So,
but yeah, when the security guard turns back, they got gas masks on, and they just start gassing everybody. No guns are fired, no shots or anything. They just have some sort of knockout gas or something on everyone there.
Yeah, the lead scientist, though, is able to grab the syringe. He clearly knows the lady scientist who's running this group. That's the character we mentioned earlier. What was her name?
Oh, you got me. Kanker? They don't say it like at all. Yeah, but she went by her first name over and over again.
Oh, just Margaret.
Okay. Yeah.
So she kind of like is right away got a kind of a flirtatious thing going on where she's kind of being coy with him. But the scientist grabs the syringe and just bolts it. He just runs for it. And we get a chase sequence where she calls in her main henchman, who is Vernon Wells' character. What's
Igo.
Igo. They. Very Igor, isn't it? Igor. Yeah.
I'm sure that was just like, all right, and his name will be Igor. Oops, my finger slipped. Ah, that works.
So he's introduced very sort of traditional, like, scary villain where he's got the driving gloves on, he's got the sunglasses on, and we just sort of see him sitting quietly in the car until he's told to chase after Martin Short. And we get this sort of extended...
No, the lead scientist, not Martin Short.
Oh, sorry, the lead scientist. Sorry. Yeah, I'm jumping ahead. He chases him a lot later on in the movie.
Yes.
So he's chasing around the scientist, and the guy's like climbing over fences. It's quite a prolonged sequence. Eventually getting to a mall where the scientist is trying to hide in the crowd.
Which, can I just... Maybe I was, you know, this was mid to late 1980s. I cannot imagine a mall looking like this. Like, they've got like... jugglers and clowns and like mascots roaming around. Like, is this just me? Was I born at the wrong time where a mall has looked like this all my life?
See, I don't know, because I wasn't around for this era of malls either. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't seem that far-fetched that
I can understand there being, like, buskers in a mall. Like, you have people performing for money or, like, handing out, like, balloons and stuff. But it seems like these people are there just for the hell of being there. Like, I don't see a single case open or anything like that.
Because I can... Because you definitely get, like, sketch artists and stuff in malls. At least you used to. Right. Maybe not so much now. I think it's just an extension of that. Maybe they're going a little bit above and beyond for the movie by having it be a bit more elaborate. But
yeah, maybe.
This feels more natural to me than, say, going into McDonald's and there's a dance-off happening.
What are you talking about, Pete? That's just every day. McDonald's is a wonderful place to be.
It's the most magical place on earth, according to Mac and me.
Yep. Is that live? Did we publish that by the time this episode went out?
I don't know. Probably. It must be out by now.
Yeah, we're good. That was like a month ago. We're good.
Yeah. That's Extra Reels over on Patreon, everyone, if you want our thoughts on Mac and me.
Hey.
Which also happens to be sci-fi, but it's also so bad that it's an Extra Reels episode.
It happens to be sci-fi, but we'll never give it to you for free.
No. You have to pay for macking me. Martin Short, meanwhile, is trying to like get a book a vacation, which, and the travel, I love this scene actually, because the travel agent is like really enthusiastic and he's like, oh, I am for you, going on an adventure and a cruise is so great. And he's like, yeah, but my doctor said no excitement. I can't have any excitement. He's like, yeah, but what about a little ship romance, eh? And the guy's like, Okay, but as long as it's not exciting.
Yeah.
This is the sort of like interactions that I enjoy in these types of movies, where it's just it's witty, it's fast, it's playing on it's dull if you explain the joke, but how could you possibly have a romance that's not exciting? Like, that's the whole point of a romance.
But that being said, because of Martin Short's character, you fully see him being it. Like, we have, as we see in a later scene, he's kind of in a relationship. Like, theoretically, he's dating this other clerk that's there, but she's like awful to him, and they barely ever actually see each other. That seems like the kind of relationship that his character would be in.
Yeah.
Of just one where it's like miserable the whole time.
I think dating's a strong one. I would say he's trying to date this woman that he works with.
They said that they explicitly had a date last night, but she never showed. So
yes, I don't think I'll count that as dating. I feel like if he walked in and said he's got a girlfriend, I'd be questioning his definition.
But see, that's what I feel like his character would consider that. He'd be like, yeah, you know, I am seeing someone. She's not seeing me, but I'm seeing her.
See, that just sounds like a stalker.
Yeah, as soon as I said it, I was like, that doesn't sound right.
So it's a love-hate relationship. I'm doing the loving, she's doing the hating.
There you go.
So he's around, right? And this entire interaction is basically that the henchman Igo, or however you pronounce it. Right? So he lifts up his hand. He sees him in the crowd, right? And he lifts up his hand and points out the finger gun. And I'm like, wait a minute. Has he got some sort of fancy concealed weapon? Obviously, later on, we find out he's just got straight up a robot hand that he can swap out attachments for. But he fires like a silenced bullet or a dart, maybe. It's hard to tell exactly what he fires. But it fires out of his finger, goes through a balloon, right, for the dramatic effect. We get the pop, right? And there's this kid who looks up at him, and he sort of blows his finger like as if he's blowing a gun smoke away.
The kid's got like a toy gun himself, and he's like, oh, that's so cool.
So he continues chasing him, but the scientist is obviously at this point injured. We see the blood in his coat, and he's coming up the elevator. And this is all designed because he's got this syringe in his pocket, and he has to be dying, because otherwise, why would he inject it into a stranger? He has to be at these last, you know, the rope's end. He has no choices left. The only hope of saving Dennis Quaid's character from the espionage is to inject him into the stranger. So the elevator door opens, and he injects Martin Short in the ass. And I didn't remember this from before, like how he reacted to it. And I was very happy that they didn't do a thing where he didn't really feel it and he just doesn't know. I appreciated that he's like, ah, you just jacked me in the ass.
My only thing is that he doesn't make a bigger deal of the fact that this man who just died in the middle of a mall has injected him with something. He just stands there like, oh no, that man is dead. I'm like, dude, you're next.
My only explanation, does he realize it's a syringe, or does he just think he's been jabbed with like something sharp?
Based off of the way he reacts when he's told syringe later on, I don't think he realized that it was a syringe, because he was told by Dennis Quaid, he's like, hey, I was in a syringe. And then he like thinks back and he's like, oh, okay, I get it.
I did feel a little prick in my ass now that you mention it.
Yeah.
Now that you mention
different
it.
From every other Saturday night.
Very good. The scientist dies. Martin Short goes off. Luckily for the henchmen, though, there was a guy with a camera taking photos. And I say luckily because when we see the photographs later, they're like all of Martin Short getting injected in the ass and screaming from it. Like, this guy with the camera was just focusing on nothing but him by the looks of these photos.
Yeah. He got not only a perfect, like, shot for Martin Short's resume, but he also got the Safeway badge on his shirt that specifically says his name and where he works exactly.
Okay, I'll give them some benefit of the doubt and say that they've zoomed in a bit for these photographs here, but still,
yeah,
it's very lucky that this camera guy was very, very focused on this
I mean,
man.
The way I thought it was going to be was that he walks over to this cameraman who's taking pictures of the dead guy. And then the henchman steals the camera and takes pictures of Martin Short, but he doesn't. Martin Short just walks away, so it must have been the camera guy taking the pictures.
Yeah. That sets that up. Which, you know, because of this, though, stuff starts happening when he goes to work, right? So we have kind of the slow rollout now of him realizing there's something going on.
Yeah. And the force of getting injected into Jack has knocked out Dennis Quaid. Like, he blacks out for a while.
Yeah, and when he wakes up, he doesn't really know where he is. He's like, wait, am I in the bunny? I'm not sure. Like, it doesn't look like a bunny necessarily. And he starts, like, doing things with his little ship where he's sending out jolts and, like, you know, EMPs and stuff. Yep. And this is notable because when he goes to his job, it starts affecting the cash register. So his nightmare plays out where the cash register starts ringing up thousands of dollars for a bottle of shampoo. And everyone's commenting on it. And he, because it's his nightmare, he's sort of reliving. He starts freaking out and grabbing people and overreacting like he does, making a whole scene.
I mean, to be fair, it's his nightmare down to the fact of there's the woman with the angry red hair.
Yes.
Who sees the number, reaches into her purse, pulls out a gun. And it turns out that it's actually just a cigarette lighter shaped like a gun, which I'm going to go ahead and say, not cool, lady. Like, it's not like you can pull that out in private settings, so be it, but don't be in the front of a grocery line and pull a gun out of your purse.
I don't think it flies in the modern day world to have anything, you know, having anything that could be mistaken for a real gun in the modern day world just feels like a big no-no.
Yeah.
So but his boss thinks he's losing his mind because he's freaking out. He thinks he's certifiable. This is also where we meet Wendy, who's actually played by Wendy Shaw. And she's just being awful, saying, oh, I forgot we had a date. Oh, there's a great moment, actually, where after the freakout, when he's back in like the manager's office and the manager's trying to talk to him, Wendy comes in with a coffee and Martin Short goes, oh, great, a coffee. And she sort of like pulls it back and says, I got it down the hall. Like she wasn't even entertain the idea of handing him her coffee.
It was a bit when he's scanning all the stuff and they see what the price is, and rather than assume it's some sort of computer error or something like that, she just turns and be like, "Way to screw it all up, Jack." I'm like, "Geez, man, what are you seeing her?"
Even the boss says that. He comes over and says, "What did you do, Jack? What did you?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think he did? Do you think he just scanned it like 100?" times or something, like,
yeah,
you know,
beep, 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 beep. $700 for your shampoo, thank you.
So he's like, okay, maybe you should go get checked out. And you know, the boss is making like crazy signs behind his back and everything, but this is where at least I would say the real comedy of the movie, because at this point, or around this point, is when Dennis Quaid goes to the ear, right? Well, actually, first he goes to the eye, you're right. This is the scene with the boss where he goes to the eye and basically injects a camera into the optic nerve so he can see out his eyes. Okay, and makes sense.
He looks around and he's like, all right, we got image. Who the hell are these people?
Oh, yeah, I love
this isn't the lab.
I love the line where he's like, those aren't scientists. That's not the lab.
Why is the bunny standing up? I don't understand this. And I think it might be at this point right now where he's just like, I was injected into a strange man. Like, that's all he says.
But when he's on the way to the doctor's, he goes up to the ear, or the inner ear, obviously, and basically starts talking throughout his speaker to try and talk to him. So we get Martin Short hearing a voice in his head in the elevator when no one else can hear it. And him sort of turning and being like, did you say something? Could you hear that? And then it continues into the waiting room where he's sort of doing that with the people sitting next to him. He's like, did you hear that? Like, no, I didn't hear anything. What is it? No, no. All of it is just, it's all just a chance for him to like overact and to sort of like jump up out of his seat, turn to the side.
Eventually you get Dennis Quaid saying like, hey, it's me, I'm inside of you. And as he gets up, he's like, oh my God, I'm possessed.
Which actually leads to one of my favorite lines of the movie, is we cut to the doctor's office and the doctor comes in and Martin Short's like sitting like, or he's all upside down on his back with his legs going up the wall. And the doctor leans down and goes, well, I think we can rule out demonic possession.
I love his reasoning for it, though, because it makes sense. He's like, you see, demons don't usually talk to you, they talk through you. And I'm like, yeah, you know, that makes sense.
I mean, at least based on movies that I've seen, it sounds reasonable.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds reasonable enough. This guy just loves getting paid constantly to take care of this guy, though.
Oh, he's maybe this was an 80s thing before, like, the greed of the modern world, but, like, how in the hell does a Safeway assistant manager have insurance to cover all of this?
Oh yeah, all his trips to, because we see his apartment soon, and it's like this little studio apartment. He's like,
yeah,
he's barely affording anything. How is he affording all these doctor visits in the U.S.?
The best insurance in the world.
Safeway takes care of his employees.
It does. That's the whole reason they're okay with this scene. They're like, you might get overcharged by $100,000, but our insurance plan.
Honestly, like, I'm almost surprised there's not more jokes in the movie about him saying, oh, there's someone inside me, and like there being like sort of like innuendo puns based around that, because I feel like most people writing this story would have been doing tons of those jokes.
No, that sounds like the thing where it's the first draft and then they realized, okay, we have too many, and then they just strip it down to like the best one that they had and they go with it from there.
Which is the right choice, but it's just, I almost expect a weaker movie to just overplay that card constantly. And I don't think this does. So credit where the credit is due for that.
Yeah.
So he goes home after the doctor, and obviously now he's alone. He's not with other people. So okay, it's finally a chance for Pendleton to really talk to him and be like, look, I'm inside you, okay? I shrunk down. I'm inside you.
I mean, you open with the I shrunk you. I feel like it takes him 10 minutes to get to the I shrunk you. Because he just keeps saying, like, you're going to have to listen to me, Jack. I'm in you, Jack. Jack. And meanwhile, Jack's just, like, watching TV, being like, no, nothing's wrong. Everything's fine. Hum-de-dum-de-dum.
Yeah, and Dennis Quaid has the Jack Nicholson mouth, where when he smiles, he's got kind of, like, it closes really sharply at the sides.
Yeah.
I don't know what point I'm trying to make. Oh, and just he looks menacing.
It comes off as like, yeah, that's the thing. It's menacing every time he's saying that. Like, you see him inside his little panel looking out through Jack's eyes, and he's like, Jack.
So he tries to prove it by, like, jolt, because Martin Short, like, tries to, like, tune him out, be like, oh, I'm going to turn on the TV. Oh, this is a good game show. I'll watch this game show. So Quaid turns up some electric juice, and it basically makes the TV and the VCR explode.
So that seems like a lot. If we're talking about, like, because at a later point they made comparisons to, like, yes, the space race and nuclear weapons, all of them powerful, but miniaturization's where it's at. If you have something the size of a blood cell that can blow out all the electronics in a studio apartment, yeah, that is a weapon of mass destruction.
It's a big deal, especially for spies and shit like that. I think... My question is, though, is that, okay, I'll buy that you can send a signal that'll blow up an electrical device, but this is technically going through this man's body, right? Like, this is, like, is this not affecting him in any way?
Well, Jack, we've got some bad news about your cancer. You now have cancer.
Because electricity, last time I checked, does affect human beings. Like, we're not immune to it.
Nah. I mean, it's... Obviously, in movies at least, if there's a large electromagnetic pulse, people are generally fine. Like, it doesn't cause any damage. So theoretically, the same things at play here. I think it is going to come down to the Joe Dante don't think about routine.
Yeah. I don't think he technically said it was an EMP per se.
But, like, that's the effect. That's what it is. It's messing with electrical devices from far away. So.
Yeah. But right away, like, So all this has been set up so far, and it needed to do all this setup because it's a very high concept movie, so it needs to take this time to do these sequences. But the real premise of the movie happens when this delivery guy shows up, right? Because there we get to what the point of the movie is that this character Putter is now in danger, even though he doesn't realize it, because this guy's not really a delivery driver. He is someone sent in by the villains to sort of case him out and see, like, oh, like, who is he? Can we just, like, you know, kidnap him, whatever.
Right.
And inside, Pendleton's like, hey, this guy's not really a delivery driver. I can tell. He's sketchy. Like, you have to go now. And immediately the guy pulls out a gun. And that's what the premise of this movie is. It's putting this character in dangerous situations that he's too scared to deal with, but you've got this more confident guy inside trying to give him instructions, trying to tell him what to do. And sometimes, of course, it'll pay off and you'll do something he never believed he was capable of, and then sometimes it'll lead to hilarious results as he tries to be tough or tries to get around the bad guys. That's what the premise of the movie really is.
Yeah, pretty much. So going back 14 episodes ago, this really reminded me, at least this first sequence, of Upgrade.
Where, okay, all right, all right. I can see it. Okay.
And a lot of times this movie kind of plays with that idea where Martin Short's character believes that Dennis Quaid is able to, like, essentially buff him up. And, like, one thing that keeps coming up is, like, oh, don't worry. Pemberton's going to give me the strength of 10 men and I'll be able to fight off anybody. And I don't think we ever actually get him doing any major modifications and stuff.
Because I don't think it was ever true. I think this is, like, it's a placebo, effectively. Yeah. Like, he thinks he's getting this extra strength or whatever from Pemberton, but he's not. He's just him. There's a great moment, like, in the third act when Pendleton's not inside him anymore, and he doesn't realize that yet, and he, like, punches like a henchman, a bad guy, like, down some stairs, and then realizes that Pendleton's not in him, and goes, wait, does that mean I just did that? And, like, yeah, you've got the strength all along!
Yeah. His character. Fireworks. Congratulations, you did it.
You could be strong too. Happy days. So, yeah, I mean, that's really when we get to the real meat and potatoes of the movie, is once we've set it up, they're talking to each other, and he's trying to help him. And it's not just obviously with bad guys, it's also confidence with women. A big part of the character arc for Putter is the self-respect. You know, yeah. I mean, because the end of the movie, like the very final scene in the movie, like, it kind of sets up more plot in a weird way that it's never going to actually deal with. But the whole point is that it's Putter who gets to make all these final choices. It's like he's not quite finally went over that line to finish his character arc. And that's what happens in the final scene. So that's what they have be the big payoff, is that he has the confidence to go and try and be a hero at the end. So, that's good.
No, I agree with all that. I think that in terms of his character arc, I think that while Dennis Quaid's character, like, you opened it up with him saying that he needs to grow up, he needs to stop being so irresponsible, all that. Like I said, I don't feel like by the time we get that 2-month time skip that we, after that point, ever see him be horribly irresponsible. Like, there are times where he has fun with things that are not super critical, but it always seems like he has a pretty good eye on the prize sort of mentality. So
with his job, yeah, I think I would argue that he does have to grow up when it comes to his relationship. And I think that is something where he's able to, you know, the big thing at the start with the cab driver thing is that he couldn't admit that, like, he's hurt because she's, like, running away.
Yeah.
He talks about his broken toe instead. So that's why later on, when he's trying to, like, bond with her and to also prove that he's inside the other guy, he says, hey, I didn't break my toe that day. It was my heart that got broken. Like, I think his being honesty and connecting with her is the growing up kind of part that he actually does do throughout the movie.
I guess it's a difference of responsibility and opening up. I think that those are two totally different things. I think that the opening up aspect he does do, and I think he does a good job at that, but I don't feel like the responsibility thing was ever a thing that was explored at all.
That's fair. Maybe they could have done more with that by the end, but
So I think the next thing is that he basically makes his way to the lab, and he tells them, like, hey, I've got Pemberton inside of me.
Yeah, they actually go there really quick, which I don't think I expected when I first watched it, is that they just go straight to the lab, and it's, what's that guy, Pete Blanchard's there, the scientists are there, and they're talking about, okay, what are the issues here, and this is where they set up some, you know, important stakes for the movie, because it's like, okay, he's in there, and we need to get this little computer chip thing back that the villain stole.
Yeah, this is straight up, like, I have never seen a greater MacGuffin.
Oh, sure. It's
just be a MacGuffin.
It's absolutely just a MacGuffin, but they set up the stakes for it really well, because we can't re-enlarge them without this computer chip, and it's like, okay, that's fine. But then they say why that's a big deal, because, oh, by the way, by about 9 o'clock tomorrow, his air supply is going to run out. And I love that they actually thought that somewhat, like, the audience would say, yeah, but he's inside a human body. Couldn't he just get oxygen via him? And they're like, no, he can't open anything because the pressure would kill him. So it is an issue. He needs the air supply.
I love how they explicitly make that Pete Blanchard's line, so that when he says it, Dennis Quaid is able to be like, yes, stupid. Clearly that's not going to work. Why would you even think that?
I will say, though, this is where you don't want to think about it too hard, but The fact that he's able to put out a flask later to collect some booze that's coming in makes you go, why can't he put out something to collect some oxygen?
Yes. Moving on.
Yeah. Also on that subject, he's so small that we're seeing the particles in the blood or whatever fluid that he's swimming around in, right? That's how small he is, mm-hmm. right? That basically the thing he's in is not really a liquid anymore, right? He's seeing the individual
right.
things.
Yeah.
And yet, when the booze comes into the body, he's able to still collect that like it's liquid. I'm like, wouldn't he be just seeing the molecules or something?
Well, I mean, the difference between a blood cell and a molecule are severe.
Sure, so, okay. I'll accept yeah. that, but...
You wouldn't see the molecules. However, the molecule, like, proportionally, the molecules would be thousands of times bigger than his body is used to dealing with, and therefore he shouldn't be able to get drunk.
Mm.
Like, you're right. It's not something that should work out. But by that logic, it also wouldn't make any sense. Like, they wouldn't even have to do the pressurization lines. They could just say, like, no, if he breathes any outside air, his body can't convert it because it's thousands of times bigger than he's used to dealing with. Like, that yeah. would be just as easy an introduction.
Yeah, but they wanted to do the booze bits because they thought that was
yeah,
funny.
Exactly.
Which is fair enough, but like, so they couldn't use that excuse.
Yeah.
But the big thing here is that when they're talking about, okay, we can make another chip, but it's going to take weeks and he doesn't have that much time. We have to get that one back. Mm-hmm. Pete Blanchard's a bit of a villain here and says, look, that's not too bad. Like, he dies, no big deal. We can mm-hmm. just, you know, whatever. And this is actually one of the times where, for some reason, Pendleton's ship has an ability that just is convenient for the plot because they have to hear this conversation, but it never right. comes up again in the movie, that he can like boost the signal to hear the conversation coming from the other room. And I'm like, why can the ship do this?
The inner ear bones are always vibrating slightly, but uh-huh. he's able to pick up on it more with computer instruments.
Okay, sure.
Sure, take it.
Yeah, but it basically tells you that they're on their own, that the scientists and the people in charge here aren't going to put his safety first, so the only way that they're going to save his life is to get that chip back, which means somehow getting it back from the villains. And that yeah. so that gives us the goal, it gives us the stakes, we have a bit of a time limit. You know, it's everything you need for a movie. It's everything you need for the plot thrust of a movie.
Yep.
So
I do especially enjoy the fact that the scientists aren't like evil about it. They aren't
no.
putting out there saying like, oh yeah, well, we'll just let him die, after all that's what test pilots are for. They're like, no, we will gladly return him to full size, but like, we don't know where the chip is, we have no way of finding it, and we our time is better spent making a new one. So it's basically, without directly talking to him, giving him permission, saying go do what you gotta do, but we're not gonna help you.
Yeah. So they sneak out, right? Immediately Pendleton's like, hey, Jack, put on that coat that's mine over there, and let's get out of here. Let's go. So they go back to Pendleton's place.
Yep, using his car.
Using
well.
His car, yeah. Mm. And this is where he wants to get drunk, so he has him like swig some booze, and he puts out his flask on this little robot arm to mm-hmm. catch some of it.
I really love the setup to the scene. It's such a tiny little character bit, but his apartment is an absolute wreck.
Yeah.
And he's just got bottles stashed everywhere. So he's like, oh, go get that bottle over on the countertop. And he pulls it out. It's like, it's empty. And he's like, oh, right. Try over here in this other location, completely separate. And it's like that tiny bit just to show how much he drinks as a character.
Yeah. And it also shows here that he's got like a suitcase in the ship with him with some stuff that he brought with him. And some of that is music. So he starts playing music and we get a scene where Martin Short's dancing to the music while he's a little bit
right.
tipsy. And he's dancing on the inside. And it's meant to be one of these little fun moments, this little kind of like moment of bonding between them and all that. But it is establishing the music thing for later because he's going to use the music to convince someone else later.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. important stuff, but...
That's what I'm saying. This movie does a great job of setting up and paying off the mm-hmm. things that it does. There's never a part that feels like it is a waste of time. It doesn't feel like it's something that is just brought up and then dropped again. Anything that it brings up, it comes back later on and says, and here's how we're using this.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is that as much as you can sort of really think about the logic of how all this stuff works and poke some holes in it, they set up everything they want to pay off later. So nothing feels cheap in terms of script structure or script,
right.
you know, writing. everything makes sense from that point of view. It's just when you sort of stop and go, but scientifically, why can it do this? And you say, no, it just needs to. Just move on.
Yeah, it's fine. Exactly. I mean, just for the writer real quick, he was involved in The Dead Zone, The Lost Boys, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, and Lethal Weapon 2 and 3.
Which one?
That was Jeffrey Boehm.
Jeffrey Boehm, okay.
The other one did nothing of interest.
All right, fair enough. So this gives him the goal. This is where they finally see each other for the first time, because he looks in the mirror so that Pendleton can see what Potter looks like, and Potter sees a photograph of him. So, you know, they're getting to know each other, and he's realizing, all right, okay, this is going to take some work to make you look presentable so we can go and get the help we need. Because Pendleton's idea is to go to Meg Ryan, is to go to her character, Lydia, because she's a reporter, and use her to try and help them, like, find the bad guys and find where they can get stuff. But he doesn't want to just tell her what's going on, because it's hard to believe. So
also, he specifically makes the point of saying, like, it's a little demasculating only being a few millimeters tall.
Oh, well, the scene where that comes up, we should mention, because that is a funny, funny scene.
Yeah, it is.
So the scene where they're having this conversation, because by this point, he's already bumped into Lydia, and he's tried to talk to her, because Lydia gets very accusatory, like, why are you driving his car? Why are you wearing his car? Because she recognizes all this stuff. She recognizes all of her ex-boyfriend's things. And he basically claims that Pendleton's in trouble, that he's effectively been held for ransom. They're at, like, a restaurant talking about it, and she's taking notes. And he goes off to the bathroom to talk to Pendleton. He's like, why can't I just tell her what's going on, tell you that you're in there? And that's when he's talking about all this. He's standing at a urinal having a piss while he's doing this. And there's a stranger in the bathroom. And he starts talking to him, and he's like, okay, but why can't I tell us? Oh, it's emasculating being this small. And he's looking down at his dick as he says, it's okay being small. Some people are, not everyone's big all the time.
He's like, you're not going to be small forever.
And this guy just walks past him and goes, play with it, buddy. Don't talk to it. It just walks out.
I specifically noted that was the exact halfway point of the movie, because I had to take a break for lunch at one point. And I was like, I'm going to stop halfway through. And that line, like, to the second, was the exact halfway point of the movie.
It's good stuff. And obviously what this leads to as well with Meg Ryan's character is, of course, that Potter thinks she's attractive as well. And, like, you know, like, Pendleton will catch him looking at her legs once every so often and be like, hey, stop that. What are you doing? Enough of that. I thought you were respectable.
Stop staring at my gal's gams.
But, you know, she does kind of agree to work with him. And they get kind of caught up together. And I'm trying to remember the sequence of events here in terms of order.
Yeah, so the sequence is, as soon as he comes back from the bathroom, Igor's there, Igo is there, and he gets jumped by him. And then Meg Ryan just immediately gives the Dirty Harry speech, except with a taser. She's like, this here's a taser. It delivers 20,000 volts into your body, and it most likely will render you unconscious, so
but
let him
go. Of course, though, after she makes this big speech threatening Igor with the taser, she accidentally hits Martin Short instead, which of course sends a jolt through Pendleton inside him, and he's all freaking out. He's all his computers are all flickering and whatnot. All very entertaining, but this... Because the reason why I'm trying to remember the sequence of events here, because I think, does he get kidnapped for a while first? Did we do all that before we get to the cowboy stuff, or is the cowboy first?
Yes. So we get a brief introduction to the cowboy stuff, and that's the whole reason that she is leaving when Jack finds her in the first place.
Yeah, we see him on the plane, because he's on his way to San Francisco.
Yeah, but he doesn't actually get involved in the plot till later.
Yeah. We just know that he puts out cigars on his bare skin. That's what he does.
Yeah, we get an introduction to, like, there's rumors that there was a break-in at the lab, but nobody's got any confirmation on anything because everything's so top secret. Meg Ryan's talking to her boss about it, the editor, and they hear that this guy that Meg's been following, who is a who fences stolen technology, who's named the Cowboy.
Yeah. Proper, like, upper level stuff as well, not just... Yeah. You know, dinky things. This is like proper industrial.
Not some Fast and Furious VCRs.
Yeah. Proper espionage stuff where it's experimental, high tech things that people would pay billions for. Yep. He's fencing that kind of stuff.
But his whole thing is that despite being this like foreign guy from some undescript country, he dresses and acts like a cowboy. And That's his whole shtick. So we just get that he's on his way to town in order to work with the villains because they're working to get both chips at that point.
Yeah.
But
yeah, because Martin Short gets shocked, Igo,
iPhone, iPod.
You go, I go, we go. He picks up Martin Short and just that's him. He's kidnapped and
well, he walks outside and sees his car that we've seen him with this whole time, which by the way has the license plate of Snap-on because of his exchangeable hands.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah. He sees his car getting towed, and so he just kicks this like meat delivery guy off of his truck and steals it, throwing Martin in the back of this refrigerated truck.
And Meg Ryan follows him, but he takes him to meet his boss, right? So the main boss is behind both him and the scientist lady, Margaret. And that's Kevin McCarthy's character, Scrimshaw, Victor Scrimshaw. Yep. And he gets in the back of the frozen truck, and he's like, hey, you know, it's like, hey, we need this guy alive. And also, this is where Margaret, we find out how horny she is, because she leans in, he's like, oh, he's freezing, and she just puts her hand right up his leg and goes, I can think of a way to keep him warm. And I'm like, down, woman, down.
I love that scene. And then the fact that it's immediately followed by Scrimshaw being like, he's used to this. He's just like, not now, damn it. Get out of here.
Not now, Margaret. Come on now. Right. But he's like, get him a blanket. And for some reason, Scrimshaw wants to stay in the back with him. So they're driving somewhere else, right? They're going somewhere. You got Igor at the front. Notably, he's got headphones on, which is important for later. But. Yep. He's in the back with his fur coat on, and he's just talking. He's got a cigar, and he's just talking. He's like, hey, you know the nuclear race? Yeah, that's a bust. You know, everyone's got them. Everyone's too scared to use them. That's not interesting. Space is nothing but a scrapyard, you know, in orbit. Waste of time. Mm-hmm. But miniaturization, now that's the ticket. That's the new frontier of warfare. And he's like, personally, I don't really care. I'm just in it for the money. So it sets up the villain that he's just this money-grabbing rich guy. That's all he is.
I will say this scene is by far the worst offender of tell instead of showing.
Okay,
like, it's just him standing there to a guy he does not know, he does not care about. He just knows that this guy has a smaller man inside of him. And he just gives his entire evil plan away. He's like, yep, this is what I do, all for the sake of money.
I think I like it, and it works for me. One, because of McCarthy's performance and just how into it he seems to be, like, telling all this. But I also kind of like it because it's not really that big. Like, it's not like a big scheme that needs that much of an explanation. He's putting a lot of, like, flavor into it, but ultimately it's just, I want to sell it. That's it. That's the whole thing.
I think it's just so weird for me, the fact that, like, Martin Short doesn't say a single word. Like, he's freezing in the back of this truck, so he's just chattering away. And this guy just decides to unload all this. Like, if Martin said even a single word of, like, why, I'd accept this entire speech. But he's just going off on his own, like he's been dying to tell somebody his evil plan.
Yeah, and I think for this character and the tone that this movie has, it works.
Oh, yeah.
That he's just
tone-wise,
eager to talk about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so inside, Dennis Quaid's like, hey, look around so I can see anything in the truck. And he's like, hey, the doors aren't locked. You could just open those doors. so he just runs for the back of the doors. And of course, Meg Ryan's been following in her car behind, right? Or I think it's actually Dennis Quaid's car, actually. It says red car.
Yeah, it's in the Mustang. Yeah. I don't want to gloss over that scene, though, because it's not just he tells him he can open the door. He, like, pumps him up. He's like, you can do this.
Yeah.
You're the man who can escape all this. You're going to get out. You're no longer the Jack of yesterday. You're the Jack of today. And he pumps him up. And so when Martin Short just stands up, bolts to the door, Dennis yells out like, no, I meant when it stopped. I mean, wait until the truck stops, man.
Well, it leads to a big stunt sequence, which is actually very impressive, where Martin Short, obviously it switches to a stuntman for a lot of the shots, but Martin Short's character, like, he's dangling on the back door of this big meat truck, right? And he's dangling off. Meg Ryan's in the red car trying to pull up behind him, and he's trying to, like, sort of, you know, there's a point where he's got one foot on the top of the windshield of the red convertible, and he's got, like, you know, he's hanging onto the door otherwise, and, like, a motorbike guy rides between his legs, and that's funny. But the most impressive part to me, all in just the whole sequence being kind of fun and thrilling and full of real stunt work, is that there's a moment towards the end of this where he successfully leaves the door. He's really scared to make the jump, So he kind of is really hesitant about it, but he ends up standing on 2 feet on top of the windshield of the convertible. Like, he's actually just balanced on top, and it looks really impressive before he falls into the car itself. But it's this whole big set piece before she finally gets him to safety and gets them away. And of course, the truck never stops, even though the boss is like yelling for it to stop, because, as mentioned, Ego is wearing headphones and listening to some music. He's got some tunes on. He's chilling. He's enjoying his day. And I'll just mention it here because I don't know where it splices in exactly. But somewhere after this scene, there's a moment randomly where it cuts to Margaret. Yeah. And she's like sucking on some grapes all succulently. And the boss man's like telling her to do something over the phone. And she's like, "It'll have to wait for now." And she hangs up the phone. And Ego's there, and he's got his hand like off, so it's just the stump, the connector, and you just sort of get a glimpse of like a silver rod, we'll call it, just goes past the camera, and she just looks like she's ready for pleasure, and
it goes past the camera, and you hear
yeah, your little buzz, and like he's got a vibrator attachment for his hand, and she uses him accordingly.
I'm that scene made me laugh.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that that's like the extent of how horny it gets.
Oh, sure.
Know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm glad it doesn't go any further with that joke.
There's, well, rule of threes, there is like one little reference to her later being horny again when the cowboy, well, it's not really the cowboy, but she thinks it's the cowboy. And she's like, "Hey, we all know about a good time, don't we, cowboy?" And she winks at him. And that's it. It's just like, oh, it's implied that the cowboy's been with her. There we go.
Yeah,
that's all we need. It's a funny scene on its own.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the very next thing is that obviously Meg Ryan's working with Martin Short now, and I do think it's at this point or it's
they go to the hotel to wait for the cowboy.
They go to the hotel and they know that she's been tracking the cowboy for so long. She knows that he always comes to this hotel. He knows like the entire itinerary whenever he visits town. So they just go in as soon as he arrives and they get the room right next to him.
And this is where the movie takes a big swing from from a science perspective. For some reason, Dennis Quaid and his little ship can send impulses to the face of Martin Short's character, Parr, and literally transform his face into someone else convincingly. And when they basically, so there's a whole actual thing before this where they go out to a club because the cowboy goes to a club, and this is where they run into Wendy, who all of a sudden thinks Potter's actually more attractive than normal because he's got some of Dennis Quaid's clothes on. And
which, I mean, I'm gonna say I was really into this sort of like weird ass love triangle plot here, because it's a unique situation. It's a no other movie I've ever seen has handled this, where there's a guy and a girl who are, the guy's into the girl, and it seems like the girl's just as receptive for the guy. And then you have the ex who's literally there inside the guy's ear the entire time. Like, it's a very different way of doing things. So I was actually interested in seeing how that was going to turn out.
Yeah, as a different dynamic for sure. Just to sort of wrap up the Wendy thing here is that she's showing interest in him, and she has a line here that kind of made me laugh just to sort of show how awful she is. She says, "You know, you're the only guy at work I've not slept with, and yet you're the only one that I'm even slightly attracted to." And Martin Short's just like, "Oh, thanks."
Great, thanks, Wendy. Anyway,
I got a chuckle out of me. So he's kind of hitting off with Meg Ryan a little bit because they're having all these little moments together. Meg Ryan goes to dance with the cowboy to kind of lure him in effectively. But long story short, they end up back at the hotel. Martin Short's convinced by Dennis Quaid to punch the cowboy because Dennis Quaid thinks that Meg Ryan's having sex with him, right? He's expecting them in a hotel room together. So Martin Short is pumped up, and he runs in the room and just punches him immediately. And to be fair, the cowboy's in his underwear.
Oh, yeah. Still wearing his boots, though. So
He loves his cowboy boots. We see earlier on he's got a entire collection of cowboy boots that he loves.
Oh, absolutely. I do love on the drive over there, though, that's where you start getting some tension between Dennis Quaid and Jack, where it's essentially Jack says, like, hey, Meg Ryan's a nice woman. She deserves better than you. Like, I think that I'd be good for her. And I love the little reveal here that Jack is getting so riled up and pissed off, specifically because Pendleton is inside messing with his adrenal gland. Like, he's poking and prodding at it, being like, I want you to be all pumped up when you got to go in there and fight him. Like, go, get ready, man.
Yeah, well, my favorite thing about this is later on with the stomach acid, but we'll get to that later. So they have the cowboy tied up, right? After he's knocked him out, they have him tied up in the bathtub, and this is where Dennis Quaid, out of nowhere, just says, okay, I'm going to try and change your face with a ship. So we get this ridiculous plot.
Yeah.
Where his face morphs into the cowboy. So we've got Robert Picardo playing the Martin Short character now, because it's Martin Short's hair, and it's his voice. They've dubbed him with Martin Short's voice, which makes sense. It would be his voice.
Yeah, they explicitly say the only thing they're changing are the muscles in the face, which somehow is enough to result in the change.
And I can't believe I just said that something makes sense in the context of this. Like, that part makes sense. If you accept everything else, this part makes sense.
I love the follow-up sequence where as soon as the change happens, he goes out and he's like, he steps out, sees Meg Ryan. Meg Ryan still has no idea about Jack being inside, or not Jack, Jack having Dennis Quaid inside of him. So she freaks out thinking that this is the cowboy who's somehow gotten loose. And she's like, what happened to Jack? What did you do to him? And he explains, it's like, it's me. Look, you can tell, hear my voice. And she's like, but how would you do that? And his explanation is, you know, I'm not really sure of that myself. And I'm like, that just sounds like the director writer being like, we're not going to focus on this. Moving on.
Yeah, don't explain it. And this is a prime example of what was said at the start, though, where everything it does with this is so much fun that you stop caring that much. You're like, okay, it's fine, whatever. Let's just go with the flow. But it is out of nowhere a really absurd thing to say he can just do this with a ship. Like, really?
I especially love the, like, if you think about it in concept of what the ship was built for, they're like, okay, this is a prototype run. You are a test pilot going into a rabbit. And they say that the entire purpose of it was essentially go in and we want to see if we can make the optic nerve thing work and the audio thing work so that, like, there is some level of you can see what it sees and it can hear you inside of it sort of thing. So why would it have the ability to A, scan another person's face, B, be able to morph that face into the other person's face, and C, I'm going to go back to the electromagnetic pulse thing because it's still weird.
Yes, all of these excellent questions that I don't think ultimately are that important, but worth pondering a little bit. Worth pondering. Mm-hmm. So this is all obviously going to be a ruse, right? They're going to go and the cowboy's meant to meet the bad guy and get the computer chip off of him. So now it's going to be Putter disguised as the cowboy and trying to do an accent, horrifically so, convince them that he's the cowboy.
So during that first scene, when he's talking to Meg Ryan, it was actually just Martin Short's voice. They just dubbed over it.
Just dubbed, yeah.
But because the second scene, he was supposed to be sounding like the cowboy, they actually had the actor who played the cowboy. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name at the
Picardo.
Moment. Yes, Picardo. They had Picardo doing it, just trying to put on a little bit of a Martin Short, like,
really okay
on the sound. So that is actually his real voice, and I guess he's faking the accent as well.
None of those accents were ever his real accent in this movie.
Right. But, like, it's a weird thing with an actor where it's like, you want to sound like yourself, but just a little bit like Martin Short trying to sound like you. It's like, okay.
I wonder if they, like, tried it as well. Like, maybe they tried to dub it and then realized, you know what, the voice that Picardo did on set sounds better than your actual attempt at an impersonation of him.
I saw trivia-wise they at least considered it. I don't know whether or not they actually went through with a whole, like, take version of it.
Yeah, or maybe they just like, okay, well, obviously you can say the lines on set, and then we'll probably end up doing it with a dubbing like we did the other scene, but maybe they just sort of liked his voice so much they went, you know what, let's just leave it.
Yeah, it's like, it seems believable. You sound like you could be Martin Short doing yourself.
So, that's a phrase. Yep. So, Yeah, we get this meet, and the bad guy, Scrimshaw, has met the cowboy before, so he's like, sort of, hey, how long has it been since we last met? He's like, you tell me. Yeah. 5 years it's been, 5 years. So they're sitting down, they're doing all this, but obviously things start to go awry. Meg Ryan's there, he claims that that's his assistant or whatever. And
sister-in-law.
Sister-in-law, sorry. And they do this whole scene, but as it's going on, like it's starting to look more and more shifty. Like there's something not quite right. Like the gold tooth that was there for surveillance or whatever falls out.
Well, no, it's just because the cowboy had a gold tooth.
Oh, is that what it was? I thought she was putting a mic in for some reason.
Nah, yeah, that's what I was thinking too. But then you see it's a gold tooth, and it's like, well, yeah, it makes sense. They couldn't change the tooth structure to make it a gold tooth or anything.
Oh, of course.
So
yeah,
it must just be a thing that they were expecting to see on him. But then during this lunch, it falls out, and that's the thing that tips him off. He's just like, I don't think you would have a gold-plated tooth. I think you just have a whole gold tooth there, buddy.
But all of this builds up to, clearly the villain, because he's about to hand over the chip, but then when stuff starts looking fishy, he sort of pulls it back and says, wait a minute. And he sort of does it friendly, like, but he's like, hey, did you guys ever know that this guy's got, a severe, tolerance for pain? And immediately Martin Short's like, huh? What? Tolerance for pain? What's that now?
That actually goes back to a much earlier conversation where when Dennis Quaid is talking to Jack, he's like, look, you just got to help me out. And Jack says, I only want one thing in return. I'll do whatever, but I only want one thing. Don't cause me any pain. Don't make me hurt. Whatever you do inside me, I don't want to hurt.
It's why they spent that time in the airplane scene, though, showing that he put the cigar out in his hand. That was setting up that he has this threshold for pain. And he's like, hey, we want a demonstration. So Martin Short's character starts freaking out. Potter starts freaking out because he can't handle the pain. He's not good with the pain. And he gets so anxious here that it basically messes up the electrode thing or whatever's happened to his face to change it. Mm-hmm. So we get this big, silly, transforming back where his face starts shaking and everything starts going all over the place. And everyone's freaking out because he looks weird. And then eventually he turns back in to Martin Short and the villain's like, it's him! It's him! I know him! Which, I guess, is the other important thing about the whole meat truck thing, is that he had to be able to recognize him later. So this is definitively knows who this guy is, so that when he turns back into him, they all recognize him. So they try and make a run for it, obviously, but it doesn't go well.
The thing that happens specifically, though, is that the chip is passed around a few times. We get it tossed about, and it ends up inside of the main villain guy, McCarthy. He's got a dog, ends up in the dog's food. And luckily, the dog did not swallow it. They do manage to find it out again, but...
Which, actually, that reminds me, earlier on, there's a scene when he's on the phone, probably when he's talking to Margaret, when she's getting Robot Man to do his business.
Is that just his name now? Robot Man?
Yeah. Or Igor, sorry. Or Ego. Igo. So... But wait, that phone call, he's in a big empty business floor of an office building. There's nothing in it except in the very corner is his desk, but notably his big white fluffy dog is just sitting on the desk. So it's like proper movie villain, because it's such an absurd location, but except just his little bit in the corner.
The very first shot is all tight, just showing his desk, so you're led to think he's in the penthouse suite or something like that. But then you zoom out and you see it's just completely empty, warehouse storage kind of building.
And it's not like he's not rich. We see because they're having this lunch at his place later, and he's clearly got a big, compound. He's clearly very financially well off. I don't know.
I don't know what the scene's meant to imply, but it was a funny little gag to just see the zoom out and see all that empty space there.
Yeah, I think... Well, so one of the other sort of minor critiques I would give the logic of the movie a little bit is that it does feel like Dennis Quaid's character moves around the body very quickly. We're given the size he is, it feels like it should take some time to get from one place to the other. Because, when he first, obviously he goes into the ass first, right? And then it's clear that he's somewhere sort of in the stomach at one point or near the stomach. And then very quickly, he's at the eye. It's like, oh shit, you shot all the way up there.
I will say that if he hits the bloodstream, then that moves very quickly throughout the body. The heart pumps that very quickly.
Okay.
So they explicitly show him being in the bloodstream. I think that makes sense. The only issue I have with it is that they explicitly say, he cannot go through the heart. They explicitly tell him, do not go into the heart. That is not an okay place to be. So because of that, I'm not sure how he manages to go from, the lower half of the bloodstream to the upper half without somehow passing through that, but I mean,
it's definitely not a big deal. But the reason why I'm bringing it up now is because we're about to have the scene where he gets passed from Potter to Meg Ryan's character via kissing.
Yes.
And I did question a little bit, like, oh, did he just happen to be like in his throat so that he could, you know, spittle across?
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, I get that they aren't like specifically saying where he is, because it is kind of left up to a thing of, right before the kiss happens, where they transfer over, we have Jack basically request saying, turn off all of your computer stuff. Like, I want a moment of privacy with your ex here. And it's left up to the audience of, oh, well, he's not able to reconnect again. There's some sort of problem. And you think that he's still inside of Jack's body when obviously he's moved over. But I think that that's the whole reason they don't specifically say where he is so that the audience can be like, oh, if we knew he was in the mouth, we'd figure out that the kiss transferred it over.
Well, I thought it was obvious anyway, because there's a close-up of like all the bubbles in the water, you know, as if like it basically heavily implies that he's traveling during that point.
That was on the kiss back. I don't think that was on the first kiss.
It was there in the first kiss as well.
First one? Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough. I guess I missed that.
It was very clear. I actually was surprised he did turn off his speakers and stuff. I thought he was just going to pretend that he did so he could still listen. No. I was expecting him to be like, you son of a bitch! You son of a bitch! You're kissing my missus! How dare you?
I'm going down and I'm snipping your testicles off. How dare you?
We know he's got a laser cutter. He uses it earlier on, so...
Yep. Why? You want a surprise vasectomy? Here's a surprise vasectomy.
So, no, like, this scene is where obviously he tells her, like, Quaid's like, okay, just tell her everything. You might as well know that we're trapped in the basement, you know, the bad guys have got us. And he does. She doesn't really quite believe it at first, but then, you know, that's when he tells him to say, hey, I regret this about the day she left, blah, blah, blah. And it's enough to convince her.
I didn't break my toe. I broke my heart.
So,
and then Jack's like, I'm sorry, what?
So it's like, yeah, okay, can you turn things off for a little bit? I want to talk to her. And, you know, they do have genuine chemistry in Kiss. And I think the first time I watched this, I was like, I actually don't know which one she's going to end up with.
Right.
Because
in these sort of movies, you always get that sort of vibe as to like, well, it could go either way, but you get the gist of it's probably going to lean towards the quote unquote hero character, like the main one.
Yeah.
But because these two split that idea of main character so well, it's impossible to tell where it's going to go.
Because on the one hand, you could sort of realize, well, there's value in the story of her realizing, oh, I can forgive Pendleton for screwing up like he did, but, you know, maybe she's moving on and this, you know, part of characters maybe more like for her. But obviously what we find out quite quickly after this, and kind of the real reveal that he's inside her for a bit here, is that he ends up, he's not up to the mouth here, but he actually sees that she's pregnant. He kind of basically stumbles into his own child, well, presumably anyway, you know, inside her. And it's a really bit, it's almost 2001-esque because it reminds you a lot of the Star Child at the end of 2001.
Oh, yeah.
So you get this big visual of this big fetus, like, inside her.
I was fully expecting the Thus Spoke Zarathustra song to start playing as he, like, crested over and saw the baby.
Honestly, I do wonder if at some point it was considered, and obviously they said no, but I do wonder if at some point in the process it was like, you know, we could do a 2001 reference here. We could play homage.
And that's when Spielberg came down and he's like, guys, you're not doing Kubrick here. Don't. Just don't.
I would have chuckled for it, but it's a good moment, but it does throw this wrench in the works of like, oh, if she does end up picking Potter, then she's got this other man's kid now, and it's kind of a weird dynamic maybe at that point.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I honestly, when it got to that point of showing the baby, I was like, this could go like one of three ways, honestly. The first is with Jack, the second is with Tuck, and then the third one is like some weird co-parenting relationship dynamic thing where like we see that Tuck takes responsibility for the baby, but then Jack is still in the relationship with Meg Ryan. So I don't know. Those are my but the way the movie ended, which I won't get to yet, but the way it ended was satisfactory. It was it set it up well enough. It made sense for what the movie gave us, but I was still fully open to the movie ending anyway by the time we hit there.
Yeah. And so, you know, they end up out of the basement, right? And this is where I mentioned this earlier, but Potter doesn't realize that he's alone now and like thinks Jack's or thinks Pendleton's still helping him. But he didn't. Mm. He actually punched out a guy on his own. But then the guy gets back up and he's like, oh shit, oh no. Like I don't have the backup now. Oh no. That's all very entertaining. All of this, like a lot of this converges at this point, but the main things that are set up is that they're escaping at the same time that the villains, Scrimshaw and Margaret specifically, are trying to use the chip, right? Because the strap thingy on the table, part of that is, and they actually get Ego to go into his own ship, but it's a very different looking ship. It's more like it's almost like a standing coffin, but with like thrusters on the side.
It's like an Iron Man suit if Iron Man were just a single square, pretty much.
Yeah, you got like a little window for his face so you can see him, right? But what's so good about this, and this is part of what makes the third act so fun, is that it's going to give Pendleton exciting stuff to do inside the body. It's not just helping Jack on the outside. Now he's got his own combat and like action on the inside, but we've got a villain inside the main character now as well. And like, honestly, if there was one thing, if you pitched this movie to me and you said, is there anything you should do in this script, is there anything you have to absolutely do with this concept, I would say yes, there has to be a villain in there as well at some point.
Here's the thing, I was looking over the producers like halfway through the movie and I saw that one of the producers was John Peters.
Hey, spiders, man, the most dangerous creature in the animal kingdom.
I was 1,000% expecting like the white blood cells to look like spiders, just like latching onto the ship and being like, oh no, your immune system's fighting against me, sort of thing. But like, no, it was more basic than that. I'm not opposed.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously Meg Ryan comes in and kind of like, she's got a gun she's taking from one of the guards, de-escalates the situation, and forces the villains into the shrinking pod, the shrinking bay, or whatever it is. So part of the third act is that Scrimshaw and Margaret are shrunk down, not to like minuscule size or like particle size, but they're shrunk down to about the size of a 3-year-old, but they still have the same dimensions and proportions of an adult. So they look really silly, and they kind of tease it a little bit because you sort of see them like sort of get into a car, but you don't really get a good look at them yet. And it's actually the same car that Meg Ryan and Martin Short go into and to drive away in a minute. So they end up in the back seat and you can sort of see them poking their heads out. The effects are very fun. The one thing that kind of gives it away a little bit is the fake hands when they're like...
Oh my God, those were nightmare inducing.
The little fake hands that are meant to be Kevin McCarthy's hands coming around and getting Martin Short, and it's just these little like doll hands that are coming around and like,
God,
touching them.
They looked horrifying. It looked like something out of like a freak show kind of setup. God.
And all this is going on whilst inside his body, right? Because when they get in the car, Meg Ryan kisses him again to put... Luckily, somehow Dennis Quaid was in position to be transferred again.
I love he specifically went up to her inner ear, played their song so that she was like, he's inside of me now. And then the moment that she made that realization, he just bolted back to the mouth being like, all right, kiss him again.
So while this is all going on, we've got Ego, or Igor, Igo, whatever his name is.
Every time it's all three.
He's flying around in his little ship inside the body and coming after Quaid's character and try to cut into his oxygen supply to make his oxygen go, which by the way is down to like 15% now, so we're getting close to the wire as to like saving him. And this all ends up with a big set piece where after some back and forth, they're in the stomach and he looks down and sees stomach acid, and it's like a pool, right? And it's bubbling like a volcano. And effectively to try and win the fight, he then starts talking to Martin Short and says, hey, I'm going to need you to like get some more stomach acid bubbling here. So starts making him think he's got a tumor. Like, I think I saw something down here. It's probably benign, but you know, by my perspective, it looked the size of a football field, so...
Right. That's my favorite bit there, where he's like, well, how big is it? And he's like, I mean, I'm not the kind of person to ask, but for me, it's like a football field. And he's just like, oh, great, all right, so, I'm gonna die.
I think what I like about that joke, fun, it's just, well, one, it just base level, it's funny that he's making the stomach acid bubble up, which literally turns the bad guy into a skeleton, right?
Yeah.
And he gets
ejected out of his ship and then is in kind of like his own little jetpack mode.
Yeah, he's flying around in a jetpack. He's like, hey, you digested the bad guy. That's a funny line. But what I really like about this, on top of it just being generally funny, is that it's actually such a good script thing to pay, like, to actually use his hypochondria to win a fight later on. This is where the hypochondria actually beats the bad guy, because he gets so worried, like he always does when he's worried that something's wrong, that actually wins the thing. That's actually a great payoff to who his character is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's, I think that Jack's plot is a great arc. I think that it goes beginning to end, and like, despite the fact that he's made huge leaps, and this is already the point where he's punched out another guard, like, he's not completely changed, like, from the base level. Yeah, at the base level, he does still have anxieties and stuff like that. He just knows how to overcome them.
He's not an action star by any means yet, right?
Right.
He's not just turned into that. He's more confident, sure. He's had these moments, but he's not some completely different person.
Right. It does a great job of showing, because this has only been literally a day. Like, there is no more time could have passed than at most, like, 48 hours.
Oh, for sure.
So there's only so much change that can be made. And I think this movie does a great job of showing that sort of transitional period of a guy who goes through some extraordinary circumstances, comes out the other side different, but not like a completely changed man.
Yeah, and well, this is all going on as well. I think by the time you get to the stomach acid, this part's over, but they're in the car, and the little versions of the villains are like attacking them from behind. So there's a lot of like skidding around. Eventually, it's actually the, what's his name again, Pete Blanchard and the scientist who are in a car who end up picking up Meg Ryan and Martin Short and taking them to the lab. And they're sort of racing against time to get back there and try and save Dennis Quaid as quickly as they can. Meanwhile, the little villains are trying to make a call in the phone booth. So you get some fun perspective stuff where they're like on each other's shoulders trying to get up to the phone. And
see, this is the part where I think the joke was fine, but they overplayed a little bit of like the explanation to the joke, like a little bit of the lead-in, because it then made you open up your mind to all the other possibilities, which is, as they reach this phone booth, he's like, oh good, a phone, we gotta call like the cowboy or whoever, someone's gotta help us. And the McCarthy says, oh well, all of my change is shrunk with me, so it won't fit there anymore. And then she says, well, what about your credit card? You know, all these rich guys should have a credit card. And he doesn't argue that point to the point where they are able to make a call. But shouldn't the credit card be a different size, too?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, like, then that's just kind of the ripple effect going back of like, well, yeah, what about like the atoms in the drink and sort of thing? Like, everything should be a different size. You should not be able to function with this world anymore.
But the visual of them in the phone booth with him standing on her shoulders is too entertaining not to enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what we were saying of they throw it out for the sake of having a good plot beat. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. So you're racing back to the lab and basically, and again, this pays off. They set up at the start of the movie that Martin Short's allergic to hairspray, which is important here because he has to sneeze him out because he doesn't have enough oxygen to actually, you know, fly the ship to like the usual exits. You're gonna have to quickly sneeze me out. So he sprays some hairspray. I do love that someone hands him hairspray, but it's like mousse, and he's like, no, not mousse, like actual hairspray.
Yeah. And then we see him sneeze out. He sneezes all over the glasses of like the lead scientist guy who's there, and then there immediately he like reflexively goes to wipe it away, and all the other sides is like, oh, no, hold on. And they go ahead and check it out, and they see, yes, the ship is in that little bit of snot on the guy's glasses. So they get him in the chamber and they start up the reverse process, which maybe I missed something somewhere along the way here, but they've coded up the like computer process to be Alice in Wonderland themed.
Yeah, so, and they don't know what the answer is to like,
right,
do the right thing.
Right, that's the part
that gets me. Well, my assumption is that the head scientist who died, the one that injected Martin Short, this was his coding.
Okay, and he would know the answer?
He would know the answer, but because it's the rest of them, they're like, I think we pick eat it and not drink it, but I'm not sure.
Right. You know, I don't know. That seems weird to me that nobody else in the office this whole time was like, which maybe someone else should know how to run the program just in case, I don't know, he gets shot.
I mean, honestly, him coming back and being put back to full size, it's all just like plot detail stuff. The more interesting thing is that when he does come out the ship and he hugs Meg Ryan and kisses her and says, why didn't you tell me? Obviously, talking about the pregnancy. I actually was surprised that he didn't do a whole thing here where she's like, wait, what are you talking about? I'll tell you what. And he's like, you're pregnant. Did they sort of leave it?
Yeah. Funny thing, though. Uh-huh. Apparently, there's a tiny little detail. If you see on Meg Ryan's desk back when she's at the news place, there's a picture of Pemberton, and pasted onto it, like just stuck on via tape, is a picture of an ultrasound. So she did know.
Very good. Yeah. I actually made a joke because I'd already looked it up by this point in the movie that when we saw the baby inside, I went, oh, there's Jack.
Yeah.
As in Jack Quaid.
Right.
Not the character in the movie. I
would love for, like, you know, he's growing up. Jack's growing up. He's like 6-7 years old. And he's watching his parents' movies that get to Interspace. And he's like, Mommy, is that me? Was I there? And she has to be like, no, you weren't around yet, so Jack, sorry.
So, yeah, but the thing here is, though, is that they're embracing each other and everyone's happy and clapping, including Potter. But he does start to look a little bit conflicted because, he's realizing that, they're back together now and any hopes that he had with her might be gone. And he's a little sad by that. And eventually, Pendleton Quaid notices him and goes over and hugs him because, like, this is them finally getting to meet. They've been helping each other out all movie. They've bonded. This is finally their friendship getting to actually become real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I liked about this is, I think the realization for me that this is the ending they're going with is that, you know, we cut to the wedding of Quaid and Meg Ryan, is that for me it's like, yeah, obviously Potter was attracted to Meg Ryan. She was this adventurous woman, someone he's not used to. He's used to being spoken to a certain way. Mm-hmm. I think it makes sense that he was attracted to her in the moment, but it ultimately wasn't that meaningful in the long-term thing. Like, yeah, she was probably destined to be with the other guy because they already had something, and also they have a kid on the way now. But they have that history, and I think it sort of ties into that idea that whilst Pendleton was inside him, he gave him a lot of himself to Potter, and that included his attraction to certain types of women, including the confidence, including the willingness to fight and all that. And I think it's more about the experience of realizing this is the type of person he wants, and that's like a life lesson he can take from it beyond just, she's now the love of my life and I'm going to end up with her. And I think that's why it's important in this final wedding scene, when you realize, oh no, the bad guys are still coming after them. They're chasing them. You know, the little villains are in the back of the limo, driving them off to their honeymoon.
The cowboy's driving them.
The cowboy's driving. And just at the last second, Potter realizes, wait a minute, that was the cowboy. But before he runs off, he turns to all the other side characters who are there for the wedding.
Doctor, Wendy, and his boss from Safeway.
Because the doctor wants to give him more tests because he loves giving him more tests. Wendy says, hey, maybe we should start dating. Maybe not exclusively at first, at least not for me, but maybe it could become something. And then, you know, the boss is like, hey, we need you back at work on Monday. And he turns to them and one by one says, Doc, I think I'm cured. Wendy, not a chance. And boss, thank you, but I quit. You know, runs off and he's like, I'm going to be the hero. He jumps in the car and chases after the couple. And even though it sets up this extra plot that they're never going to do anything with, the whole point is that, no, he doesn't need the help anymore. He's going to go and be the hero because that's who he is now. So that's why it's the ending part of the movie. So
I think it goes back to an earlier line. I think it was actually when he was arguing with Pendleton in the car, which was, he's like, oh yeah, she deserves better. Like, you know, she sees something in me. And we have Pendleton specifically reply with, like, yeah, she sees me in you.
Yeah, that's a good line, yeah.
And, like, obviously it's taken literally in that way of, like, you know, I'm the one who's literally telling you what to say some of these times, but it also works the other way of, like, that confidence, that sort of way that he's learning to be more like Quaid's character is, you know, rubbing off on him.
And keep in mind, he's driving his car, he's wearing his jacket, even the first time he sees her. Like, there's all these little reminders of the guy she's actually been with constantly around him.
Absolutely. And I think that is why the ending does work for me. Like I said, I could have seen it going either way, but the way that they justify his character of that, he's not you know, interested in Meg Ryan because he's genuinely in love with her or anything like that. I think it's much more of a thing of he would never have had the confidence to, like, approach a Meg Ryan prior to this. He would never have had the confidence to ever do that sort of thing. And it's only now, after the fact, he's basically getting rid of every aspect of his old life, just saying, like, nope, that's the old me, this is the new me. And he's going to be able to go out and find a woman like Meg Ryan for himself.
Yeah, the happy ending, in a weird way, is him telling Wendy to get lost. That's the happy ending, is that he doesn't need to chase after her anymore.
Mm-hmm. The ending here is not that he finds love. It's that he learns to love himself. Yeah. It's that he has this new renewed self-confidence, which is going to impact every other aspect of his life.
And he clearly has a good relationship with both of the other main characters because they both kiss him on their way.
I mean, it seems like he was the best man at the wedding. Yeah. I don't know whether that's true, but it seems like he was.
So, yeah, I mean, all that stuff is very... It does make me wonder, though, why was Wendy even at this wedding? Because, like, she doesn't know the other two characters. Same with the doctor. Same with the...
I mean, the doctor and the boss, yeah, no, I got nothing for. Wendy, I could theoretically say, may have been the plus one when, like, he was still kind of, like, trying to figure out what he wanted to do with his life. But, yeah, the other two, I got nothing for.
Yeah, that's fair. Just also, because, fun scene, that's all. That's all you
need. Yeah. Also, just want to throw this out there. What was the time period here? Because she was already clearly 2 months pregnant. We have an exact time scale on that.
Shotgun when? This was like 2 weeks later.
This was 2 weeks? She's just like, yep, we went through a traumatic experience, therefore, let's get it done with.
She's still not showing, and, you know, clearly there's no baby being babysat anywhere, so, yeah, I have to assume it's very quickly.
Also, the only other thing that I wanted to throw in there is that the whole reason that the bad guys are, like, in the trunk and driving the car is because, for some reason, God only knows why, this science lab decided to let Dennis Quaid use these MacGuffin microchips as his cufflinks without, like, stripping any data or anything out of them. So he's just got them on his body at all times.
Well, did they let him or did he, like, slyly steal it? Because the way he said, hey, did you notice my cufflinks? It kind of felt like he was doing something he wasn't supposed to.
I mean, yeah. I mean, maybe he did just take them. But I would imagine that still would send off alarm bells where all of the different scientists would be like, oh, God, we lost them again.
I'd like to think they're making more, though, because the whole point was is they can make more, but they just can't do it quick enough to save them. That was the crux of it.
That's fair. Also, I just realized something as we were talking here. So we see that the guy who stole the chips, McCarthy's character and then the scientist lady, they have their own shrinking tech and their own lab and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they selling the chip if they have their own lab that they would like to personally use this for?
Well,
so that's inner space.
There's not really a good excuse for that, but because we want to have them be shrunk down because it's funny. But
yeah, that's probably the whole reason. They couldn't get back into the normal lab.
Maybe there's a reason, right? Comments can let us know. But I don't have a good explanation for that other than just maybe she's supposed to confirm they work before they sell them kind of thing.
Or maybe
more to the point is they're going to duplicate it first before they start selling them off. Like, the idea is they're not just going to not have it anymore.
That could work. So they already maybe have already gotten, like, schematics and stuff from it.
Yeah, and they've fully built the rest of the devices. They just need...
Right.
This is, like, the finished ingredient, the final piece of the puzzle kind of thing.
All right, I can accept that. That's fine, that they already made a copy of it.
That's all I've got for you. But anyway, I mean, that is pretty much the movie. I think it's a very fun character sci-fi comedy, ultimately. Mm-hmm. There is some fun set pieces. There's a cool, menacing villain. Kind of cheesy in a way, but fun cheesy. There's a couple of good set piece moments as far as, like... So I think in terms of practical stunt work, you've got the car bit where he's hanging off the back of the truck and he's doing all those fancy split stuff, try to switch between one and the other. I think all of the fight stuff where Igor is inside the body is like sort of the villain shrunken down and fight, it's like a ship battle inside Martin Short's body. I think that's super fun and inventive.
I think it's fun and inventive, but I think I might have wanted a bit more of it, or at least in more locations, because it's basically like a generic in the body location and then the stomach. I kind of wanted a bit more of like using the body to its full potential sort of thing.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing where maybe instead of doing it during the car chase, what if it was like they were prepping him to try and take Quaid back out of him, but then they reveal, oh no, the other guy's still in there. So maybe we get more just like his body twitching and like, why is he reacting so weird? Something's happening inside him as this battle's taking place. But at that point, though, you'd be stretching the movie out even more.
Oh, yeah. So. Like we said, I don't think this movie needed to be any longer, and I can't think of anything that I particularly would want to cut or shorten. I just think that in terms of a set piece, I don't think that it did as much as it could have done.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. I think ultimately it's not my favorite Joe Dante movie, but it has a lot of his hallmarks. It's a really fun concept. It may be like the biggest budget movie he ever did, though. If I'm thinking about it.
I mean, that would make sense. It was a $27 million budget. It was technically a flop. It only made back $42 million in theaters, but...
Well, at least... big relative... Because, like, I mean, given that budgets inflate over time, it wouldn't surprise me if some of his later stuff was technically a bigger budget in terms of the amount, but it wasn't as big in terms of what a big budget is, if that makes sense. Like, you know...
Right.
So... This felt like a high, because of the cast that's involved, because of all the effects involved of all the inner body stuff. It feels like a bigger spectacle than some of his other things. But
yeah, I will say he did the Looney Tunes Back in Action movie, and that one had $80 million in 2003 money, which seems like it's probably still bigger.
Yeah, at least comparable anyway in terms of the scale between the two. But
yeah.
But then again, that is Looney Tunes. Maybe they're like, hey, we can bank on this because Looney Tunes are in it. I've actually not seen that one.
I mean, in terms of banking on it, the answer to that is no. You can't bank on Looney Tunes movie.
No. Sadly, Joe Dante has never been that much of a commercial success, even though I love most of his movies. But luckily, he kept getting to make them for most of his career, though. So there's a nice filmography to look at. But... all that said, let's rate Innerspace out of 10.
Sure, yeah. Honestly, don't really have much more to say in terms of like reasoning for it. I think this one is pretty much just straight down at a 7. I enjoyed it. I think it was a very well-done movie in terms of comedy. I do think that while it does have its flaws to it, the flaws are mostly overlooked just by the pacing of it, the general structure of it. It feels like a well-made movie. They're just, I don't know. It seems like something's holding me back from giving it the 8. I wouldn't say that it's quite at like that great standard, but 7 just seems right about where I'm coming at.
Yeah, sure. I think any faults you could levy at it are fundamentally just things that are like... I don't think anyone was dumb when they were making the movie. They just sort of made the choices that, no, those will get in the way of us having the fun plot. So we're just going to have the fun plot. And we're going to have the characters be endearing because of the fun things we're having them do. And a lot of the actual character arc and story is definitely there. I do think it's a movie with a lot of love in it, which is typically what I like about Joe Dante movies. I think for me, maybe it doesn't quite hit great, but I'm going to go closer than you. I'm going to say 7.5.
Okay.
I think it's a really good movie, and it's one that I think, you know, this is my second time seeing it. I don't know if it's gotten better now that I've seen it a second time. I think there's other Joe Dante movies that have grown better with me over time, but it's a really fun concept. It is almost like, because it's bigger, ironically bigger, despite the premise being someone's getting shrunken down, maybe some of the smaller charm of it isn't quite. And that's not to say that The Burbs has Tom Hanks in it at the height of his career, so it's not like he wasn't getting stars in some of his other movies, but it was much more lower key in terms of premise, right? It was much more, I imagine it was a smaller budget, unless Tom Hanks was getting paid a shit ton in 1989, but
yeah, probably. So,
anywho, that is Innerspace. We've done it. That was another vote winner, because there's a voting tier on Patreon. They get to vote on an episode every month for a few mm-hmm. of the different movie shows. I also mentioned earlier on that there's bonus shows. Every month, me and David do two Patreon-exclusive shows. One is the Criterion Cut, where we review movies from the Criterion Collection. And then the other one is the opposite of that, where we do extra reels, which is where we review some of the worst things ever made. Hence, Mac and Me being an episode of that.
Yay.
So you can get access to those over in Patreon at two of the earlier the tiers down low in the list. So go and have a look if you want to support the show and the content and help keep it all coming. It's much appreciated, anyone who does go over there and do that. We always want to thank our patrons and YouTube members and things like that who financially support us. But of course, you can just, you know, hit the like button, comment. All these things do help as well. But before we go, there's the one bonus segment on the Atomic Cinema Experiment, and that is David going back and watching a movie that was done in the show before he joined it to catch up and all the things he missed. So
that's
what was
the name of the segment.
What all of that was the name of the segment. What movie did you watch for your homework this week?
Well, I am once again trying to muscle through a bunch of stuff that I need to get done before a new installment is watched, and therefore this time I have done Alien Resurrection.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yep. It's got to get that done before we do Prometheus, which is very quickly approaching, but boy, that was a movie. So I didn't actually get a chance to listen to you and Tara's original reviews. Did you watch the original cut or the special edition?
Original cut.
Original cut? Thank God. Okay. Because there was apparently a few changes in the special edition that I wouldn't have known about. But yeah, no, it's... I can feel that Joss Whedon wrote this movie. And I'm not saying that as a positive or a negative, but I can feel the kind of, like, Whedonisms throughout it, if that makes sense.
And for the record, I am a fan of such things. I like that about the movie. Just my quick summary of my feelings on Alien Resurrection is I actually think it's a pretty entertaining movie until it falls off a cliff in the last, like, 20 minutes when it gets really weird.
Yeah, no, thank you. Because that is pretty much where I was thinking of it as well. It is a... I think that there's a strange opening concept, especially for someone who very quickly made his way through the Alien franchise. This one feels like just out of left field.
It's kind of weird.
Oh, now we're much farther in the future and we're just doing a bunch of weird stuff. And I'm like, all right, but once you accept that concept, I think it's an entertaining enough movie. I do think it is weird that this movie... for me at least, does the most to feel like it's futuristic, despite the fact that all of the movies have been set in the future. This is the first one where it feels like they're introducing, like, there's one segment where a character wants to pour himself a whiskey, and so he pulls out, like, a cube labeled whiskey, and he sets it in a glass, and then this weird laser machine just turns it into a liquid. And I'm like, is that honestly the kind of tech we would need to get in the future rather than just keeping things bottled? That seems more complicated to me. That and there's also apparently still a shopping channel 200 years after the aliens.
Hey, that was very common in the mid-90s. I can see why they thought that would be a staple.
That's fair. I'll give them that. The extrapolation from what they know, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, I think the movie looks really good. Like, I think Jean-Pierre Jeunet's visual style gives it a really cool grungy vibe.
Mm-hmm. I will say, compared to Alien 3 special effects, like, top tier, 200%.
Sure. Yeah.
It looks so much better than Alien 3 ever could possibly dream of looking.
Yeah, yeah. It's got a fun cast. I like Ron Perlman in there. I like, I can't remember the guy's name, but the one that's in the wheelchair. I think he's pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. And this was a very early role for, God, why am I blanking on her name?
Winona Ryder.
Winona, yep, that's it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Overall, I think looking at your guys' scores of a 6.5 and a 7, I don't think it quite gets that high for me. I did have some fun with it, but I think overall it is still just a little bit lesser, so I'm just going to go with a flat 6 on that.
Yeah, sure. I think liking enough of it, plus some nostalgia, does some lifting for me. Like I say, though, I do definitely not like the last, like, 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to spoil it too much, but the moment that, like, final reveal hits, I'm like, okay, so we're just doing a completely, like, just ignore the rest of the movie. This is its own thing now. Okay, cool, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a shame, but still, though, there's fun to be had in there, mm-hmm. Thereabouts, so... All right, okay, there you go. That's it, Alien Resurrection in the can for you.
All ready for Prometheus.
Way, hey, Alien Day, everyone. Mm-hmm. Alien Day's coming, and with it is one of the most anticipated movies that I went to the theatre to see, and one of the more feelings of ambivalence as I left the theatre, so...
Which one was the greater disappointment, Prometheus or Batman v Superman?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'd have to ponder that and weigh up.
Well, you got a month to get your feelings in order. I'll ask you again when we do Prometheus.
Interesting. But yes, that is the show, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us. We do appreciate it. Keep watching science fiction and computer ad salsa.